Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. I am your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm in conversation with a very, very accomplished individual from the US, Mr. Chris Wayne. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Chris is currently the non-executive chairman of the Startup Policy Lab in the US. In his earlier avatar, he was the deputy US chief technology officer in the Obama administration. He has worked with the World Bank, with the Dome Advisory, and with PwC Australia. So Chris, such an amazing track record of professional leadership. When I was reading about you, you say that you're an administrator, leader, evangelist. And then you go on to say, I rebuild organizational capabilities so that communities can come together and better solve the biggest challenges facing the world. Help me understand this.
That is a mouthful, isn't it? So let me start by saying back in about 1996, I was on vacation and I was reading a Harvard Business Review document called We Should All Have Big, Hairy, Audacious Goals, okay, or BHAGs, yeah, if your listeners are aware with those. And I read that and the proverbial light bulb went off. I had just finished up working in the White House supporting three presidents in an administrative role. And I was about to start a new chapter in my life with technology and taking technology and using it to improve problem solvings in the public sector, the private sector, the nonprofit sector. Mm-hmm. And I think it really is that big, hairy, audacious goal need that I have that has sustained me throughout my entire career and has brought me some amazing experiences. And I think secondarily, it is the ability to deliver on those big, hairy, audacious goals. And then finally, to basically scale them, whether that be in a small industry or whether that be worldwide. And so that big, hairy, audacious goal, that vision, that need to have a dream, I think is the foundation upon which I have been lucky enough to administer. I've been lucky enough to lead, and I've been lucky enough to convince others to follow. And that's why I wrote what I wrote.
Amazing, amazing. And, you know, while we will talk about Startup Policy Labs in a few minutes, you're the first person I'm speaking to who has actually worked for US presidents and who has, you know, been the deputy US chief technology officer in the Obama administration. So for our viewers and listeners, my question to you is, how do you prepare for yourself for a role in the White House? And what have been some of your key learnings?
Well, I don't think you can ever prepare for a role in the White House. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I was very lucky to have started my career in the White House from an administrative role and supported in a non-political role three presidents. And it's very unusual. In fact, I don't think anybody can do that anymore. So I started in the Reagan administration, worked in Bush, and then ended that in the Clinton administration. And so I saw how to run the White House, to administer it, to finance it, and to make sure that it was well run. Mm-hmm. But I also watched from the policy perspective, those people that were successful and those who weren't successful. So by the time I joined the Obama administration, I had a very rich history of experience to depend on. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of lessons, we could talk all day about the lessons, but I think that the most important lesson for me was the need to really understand and execute the power of persuasion. Mm. When one thinks of the White House, one thinks that you have infinite power, you have infinite money, you have the president speaking for you, and that everything will just happen your way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way at all, because the president is very powerful, but you're also dealing with a very large bureaucracy with lots of people who may or may not enjoy or support your particular agenda, mm-hmm, nor do you necessarily have any money. So in each of the roles, in each of the functions, in each of the assignments that I was given, I had to work with an incredibly complex group of people and organizations and convince them to do what I wanted to do in addition to what they were already being tasked to do. And what I found, and it will be no surprise to your listeners, is the absolute need, even though you're in the White House, to create relationships with everybody and build those relationships on trust. And quite frankly, take those relationships and first and foremost, use them to help the other person do their job better. And once you've done that, once you've helped them, once you've got them on your side, so to speak, then they will help you and they will help you very much. And so my one and only, given our time, is this need to persuade based on relationships.
Very interesting. You know, what you're telling me is actually an amazing truth that, you know, until you have strong relationships and bonds, very little can get done. But I didn't realize that happens in the White House as well.
Oh, yes. So,
fantastic. My next question to you is, you've done such amazing work, but let's talk about your role as the Chief Innovation Officer for Global ICT Development at the World Bank. What was the role and what were some of your learnings?
It was a fascinating time to be in the World Bank, and it was also a fascinating position to have. Mm-hmm. The World Bank was undergoing one of its first redesigns, and so everything was up in the air, everything was on the table. We were able to talk about changing the World Bank, which mm-hmm. is an unusual thing in such a large organization. So it was a wonderful time. My position was brand new. No one had ever had it before. And I had a remit that was simply too large. I think I had 5 major tasks that I was supposed to accomplish. In the middle of all of that, I traveled around the world. And what I came to understand to be the true need for innovation in the World Bank was to figure out how the World Bank could use technology to speed up the development process, to help finance ministers and chief information officers and chief technology officers and presidents of these countries that unfortunately suffer the poorest of the poor, and figure out how we, the bank, could actually not just give a loan for development, but actually teach people how to use technology to accelerate the development of solutions to poverty. And that was the most exciting opportunity that I had. And as I said, I think I went to every continent in the world and just met with amazing people. And back to what I said, the dream, how do we take technology and speed up the development process? How do we build the capability and how do we convince other people to do it? Mm-hmm. And I did that for several years and had some of the richest experiences and hopefully had the richest benefit of my entire career.
Amazing. So Chris, now let's talk about Startup Policy Lab. You know, as the non-executive chairman, tell me about this venture.
So back in about 2012, the United States was having some difficulty with legislation that was being proposed that on balance made sense when you thought about it, but would have detrimental impact on startups. And I was part of a group of people who were thinking about, what do we do about this? Clearly there's a disconnect between what the politicians in Washington, D.C. wanted to do and what actually would solve the problem and not harm entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And we watched this kind of train wreck happen in Washington, D.C. And luckily, through the hard work of a lot of people, we were able to slow it down and actually stop it. Now, that was good because the first problem was solved, but we were left with, now what do we do? Mm-hmm. How do we actually teach policymakers and those people who are building startups about each other and what the goals and objectives are for each of the two players? And thus the Startup Policy Lab was born, and it was born with the simple idea of, let's get everybody talking, let's connect, get everybody talking, And we were naive in thinking that simply by having that conversation, one side would teach the other, and we would somehow in the middle of all of that move things forward. What we soon found out is talking is not enough. We had some great conversations, but I don't know that we moved the needle particularly far. Mm-hmm. What we realized is that we had to start embedding that conversation actually in the policymaking process itself. And what we started to do was to take a big, hairy, audacious goal like elections and making sure that people were able to vote in elections, a basic tenet of democracy. And how do we ensure that that happens? And we started meeting with secretaries of state in the United States of all the 50 mm-hmm. states and figuring out what their needs were and looking at the state of technology. And then at that level, to the local level, started working on providing solutions. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the Startup Policy Lab is now. It is a place to actually bring people together and build policy, not just talk about policy.
Fascinating. And, you know, again, when I was reading about you, there is a comment that says that government that is open, transparent, accessible, innovative, and secure. And I wanted to ask you, does such a government exist anywhere in the world?
That is definitely an aspirational statement.
Okay.
But let me go back to the beginning of the Obama administration. As you may know, the first executive order that President Obama did or signed was around open government. Okay. And over the next 8 years, we worked, including myself and many, many others, to really create a systemized way to open up government, not only in the United States, but across the world. Mm-hmm. And we were successful in doing that to a certain degree. And then we had a new president come into the United States who didn't necessarily agree with that, mm-hmm. and it all stopped. So to answer your question specifically, it is possible.
Okay.
We saw it happen. We saw it work. We saw it go worldwide. Was it perfect? Absolutely not. Did we have a lot of effort yet to do? Absolutely. But it is possible. It did happen. It still exists in small pockets. And I think now under the Biden administration and hopefully future administrations, we can pick those pieces up and run with it again.
Fascinating. So, you know, you also just mentioned that the Startup Policy Lab is about not just about getting people together and creating an environment where policy can work. My question to you is that, you know, based on all your experience since 2012 when you started this, give me some examples of where policy has helped startup entrepreneurs.
I'll give you two. And I was involved with both of them. But let's start with San Francisco. When I was chief information officer of City and County of San Francisco, we were one of the first cities in the world to open up our data. And we created Data SF as a way to have sunshine, to open up and create that trust in government. But what happened is that entrepreneurs started taking that data and building applications, in fact, building businesses around the access to that free data, and really helped build a thriving startup community in San Francisco. We took that and then moved that to the US government, and we use at data.gov. And likewise, we watched the same thing happen. Data.gov has become foundational to American business and even European business and worldwide business as a way of feeding in the data to create products and services. Mm-hmm. I think specifically, we've seen changes happen in organizations like our Securities and Exchange Commission, where they've had to improve the use of crowdfunding, and we've taught them how to do that. Mm-hmm. We've had national conversations at other organizations. And so I think, it's that platform, if you will, where you have data that gets shared, and then you have the intelligence that brings it all together, and then you have the entrepreneurship that applies it. you know, those are straightforward startup principles. Mm-hmm. And what we've been able to do is take that to complete branches of government, as well as individual agencies. And I think the economic output for the US and for other countries has been pretty astounding.
So, you know, what you're saying is so fascinating. I mean, for a government to open up its data for mm-hmm. others to use, I mean, it goes back to what I was asking you, that there is openness and transparency.
Yep.
But do you think, a lot of other governments in the world will be open to giving out their data?
I think it's cyclical. Mm-hmm. I think it is something that can happen and was happening. And then we've hit a period where it's kind of going back down. I think that COVID, though, was one example where countries like Australia took the opportunity in a very awful situation mm-hmm. and started looking at how do we actually trace, how do we make sure that we understand what's going on in the community with infection rates. Mm-hmm. And they did open up their data and they did use it effectively in terms of applications and tracing and whatever. And so I think it's a prime example of even in today's environment, it is possible for governments to open up and share data and solve very specific problems.
Mm, fascinating. And, you know, if you were to look at the US and the state that you are in, I mean, it is the mecca of startups. It is where the whole startup world has commenced from. I don't think there is any country in the world that does not want to have a Silicon Valley equivalent in their country. My question to you is, what holds back so many other countries from having policies that you have in California?
Look, I get asked this question a lot, and I think the Silicon Valley didn't happen quickly, and it didn't happen by accident. It took many years in order to get to where it is, and we could again spend a long time talking about the various pieces that are required to get to a Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the one fundamental difference that I've seen with my travels is an openness, back to your question about openness, an openness to try something new and try something different and to not fear failure as much as other people do. I was just referring back to Australia, and there is a, for example, a description of Australians called the tall poppy syndrome, which is you never want to get too far above everybody else because mm-hmm. people are going to shoot you down. So it depresses, if you will, the ability, the natural innate ability for us to experiment, to grow, to try new things and build new value. And I think in California specifically, with the money that is here, with the people that are here, with the rules and regulations, the policies, we have created an environment where we can fail, and we do fail quite often. In fact, I have failed many times in my career, but it's actually something to be celebrated, not something that is used to tear us down.
Fascinating. One more question for you before I move to a few questions for you personally. This is the age of the millennials and the Gen Zs. From your perspective, how are millennials and Gen Zs changing or forcing government to change policies for startups?
Again, using COVID as an example, you can't read a periodical or a newspaper or watch TV without hearing about the future of work mm-hmm. and how people have become so used to working from home and they don't want to go back to work. And if you start digging down a little bit, it's not necessarily people who are my age who want to stay home. It's the millennials, it's the Gen Zs, it's the younger people who are very comfortable in non-traditional roles, non-traditional structures. They are open, back to this open government idea, but in a private sector standpoint or a work perspective, they are open, they aren't used to, they don't want the same kind of structures that you and I grew up with. Mm-hmm. So they are not only supporting our ability for incredible economic growth right now, but they are perpetuating it by saying, we won't go back. we are not interested in going into that same structure. And if you look again at what is being written, all the managers are scratching their heads going, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So to answer your question specifically, they are moving the needle. They are moving us forward in ways that probably would have taken decades before, but they're having their say. And as the growing proportion of labor in the marketplace, they have incredible clout and they're moving us into a whole new world.
Fabulous. So Chris, I'm now going to move to the last segment of our conversation. All our viewers and listeners, they love to get to know the guest a little more. So I have time for maybe two, maybe three questions for you personally. My first question to you are that, you know, given that you worked across so many sectors in so many countries, what are some of the core values you have always believed in?
Good question. I've always been so busy doing that I haven't really thought much about this. I think that the first is one has to be curious. One has to have an amazing sense of curiosity to be successful in this world. One has to want to learn. One has to want to solve problems. One has to figure out how to do that. And that all requires curiosity. I think the second is that if you are going to embark on these crazy, big, hairy, audacious goals, as I have, you have to be ready to persevere. You have to have patience and you have to persevere because there are going to be a gazillion roadblocks thrown up in front of you. And it's very easy to get discouraged and it's very easy to give up. And so you have to have that perseverance, that ability to wait all of your enemies out and actually get what you want. And then I think I'll end with what we've already talked about. You have to be very persuasive to get people to do what you need them to do.
Fascinating. My next question to you is that for someone who's seen so much, what does success mean to Chris?
When I can get a problem solved. It doesn't have to be solving climate change, although that is definitely one of the issues we need to solve. It can be as simple as solving the problem for one of your users in your users group. It doesn't matter. As long as you're taking this wealth of experience, all of these tools, the technology, the non-tech, doesn't matter. When you can actually engender problem solving in your office, in your city, in your country, whatever it is solving those problems one by one and not letting your ego get involved in saying, you know, we should be doing this, or we need Elon Musk here, or we need Zuckerberg here, or whatever. It is simply helping others solve the problems that are important to them and meeting the mission of whatever organization they're working for. One by one.
Interesting. And a follow-up question from success is that who or what inspires you to keep on doing such amazing stuff across multiple sectors?
I think it is a very personal answer to that question. My mother, who is 93, recently passed away, and she taught me at a very early age that you don't have to have much in this world. Take what you've got and make what you can. And she taught me that, and I've taken that and done and used those lessons in every job that I've had, and it has stood by me every single time.
Fabulous. What an amazing learning. Take what you've got and use what you can.
Yep, absolutely.
Amazing. So I'm now going to stop our conversation because we're running out of time. But Chris, thank you so much. This has been such an amazing conversation. Thank you for sharing such amazing things that you've been doing all along. You did mention about what made Silicon Valley, and I'm looking forward to hopefully having another conversation on what made Silicon Valley, because the rest of the world would really want to know about that.
I would love to have that conversation.
Thank you. But thank you again for this conversation. And I look forward to staying in touch.
Sounds good. Thank you much.
Thank you for listening to the brand called You Videocast and Podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.